A busy ballot and the coming silver tsunami for Broward County. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This November's ballot will be a busy one. There are state, federal, and local races, as well as local issues, and 12 amendments. We're going to take a closer look at a couple more of those amendments, and we're going to ask why some of them are bundled together. Plus, actress Alyssa Milano has been an outspoken voice in the Me Too movement and in support of greater gun control. She was in South Florida this weekend standing side by side with students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas during a festival. We'll hear from her. And Broward County is going to see its senior community massively expand within the next decade. But a new report shows that the county's not ready. They don't have enough affordable housing or public transportation to provide this growing sector of the community. We're going to look at that and more today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this year's ballot will take some time to go through. Besides the gubernatorial and Senate race, there are congressional races, local races, and numerous other local issues. Add to that the 12 state constitutional amendments. And remember that some of those amendments are bundled together, so you need to read through it to make sure you know what you're voting for. We're joined now by Tim Serio, Governor Rick Scott's former general counsel and a member of the Constitutional Revision Commission. That's the group that meets every 20 years to propose amendments for the voters to choose from. And he joins us now from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Tim Serio, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis. Thanks for having me back.
So are you content with the dozen amendments that did make it to the November ballot?
I am. I think that it's been a good process. I think the CRC, which, as you know, is only probably I think we have eight of our amendments are on the ballot. The remaining came from the legislature or citizen initiative. But I think it's a good process. We have gone through a judicial review. The Supreme Court reviewed our work, and I believe one of them was taken off the ballot, but the remainder are on, and we'll see what the voters have to say.
So take us back to – I mean this was a process that took almost a year basically, lots of meetings,
right.
Public meetings, making sure that you hear from the citizens. Really your experience overall and some of the things that you saw during that time.
It was an amazing experience. It was great to get around the state a couple of different times, hear from the people of Florida, very, very passionate about their issues. We have a very well-informed and engaged population here in Florida and a very vocal one. And I think we heard from divergent interests, a lot of input. A lot of ideas, it's very difficult. I think we had over 1,000 proposals that were submitted. I think almost every proposal that came forward represents some type of citizen input, even though most of them were sort of refashioned and rewritten and proposed by commissioners. But all of this arose out of a great amount of public input, and I'm just really, really proud to be a part of it. It's something that I'll remember for many, many years.
Were there any concerns about the fact that there is going to be a lot on the ballot?
Yeah. I mean, you said it yourself in your intro that the ballot is going to take some time to go through, and that's absolutely true. And part of the issue that we struggle with and that the CRC 20 years ago struggled with and the CRC 40 years ago struggled with is how do we present these issues to the voters? And, you know, and you had mentioned the bundling, and part of the reason was if you can take concepts that are arguably similar and combine them, it will you know, promote ballot brevity to the extent we can in any way call this ballot somewhat brief, and also hopefully prevent voter fatigue. So that's why we did what we did. I know there's been a lot of interest in that, and I'll be honest, there's a little bit of misinformation out there about the bundling, and that's why I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk about it.
I mean, you kind of touched on it. So you try to figure out how to bundle different amendments together that would
right.
be similar. So let's look at like one, and you know, this is the one that really has probably gotten the most attention, which was Amendment 9.
Yep.
Banning e-cigarettes indoors and ending offshore oil drilling. So,
right.
I mean, people are going to say, wait a second. How are they similar?
So I don't want to sound flip about this, but the easy answer is okay. It's, you know, clean air, clean water. People care about, you know, being in a smoke-free environment. People want clean water. The truth of the matter is we really wrestled with it, and we were trying to promote a shorter ballot, and these were both wildly, wildly popular initiatives. They pulled apparently, and we've got third-party information, they pulled through the roof. So generally our approach to bundling was, okay, what we don't want to be accused of is trying to combine something that's clearly unpopular or something that barely passed the CRC with something very popular. I would say, I shouldn't have been surprised just because of the concepts, but because I knew how popular both of those initiatives were, I think at the time me and many other folks on the CRC didn't see any problem with combining them.
Were there any of the bundles, amendments that you felt those don't work?
Not at the time, no, and still I don't. I want to be careful how I say this. One thing that you need to keep in mind is simply because something is wildly popular with the electorate or probably will be popular does not mean that there are not unhappy special interests. And there are, and I'm not blaming them. I mean, they're in an industry and they have a right to protect their industry. But there are folks that the only way they can attack, because some of these are very popular concepts, is to attack the process.
You talked about some misinformation out there on the
right.
Bundling. So help us understand what is the misinformation? What are we getting wrong?
So there's a narrative out there, and I'm not saying it's been this outlet, but several media outlets, and they've gotten some bad information, have written that the CRC, in essence, sort of pulled a fast one, or they're bundling and they're doing something that they should not have done. And nobody, a lot of what we did as the CRC this year, we tried to take from the processes and procedures of 20 years ago and 40 years ago. This year, and again, to hopefully promote ballot brevity, at least to some extent, and prevent some voter fatigue, we bundled 22 proposals into what are now 8 proposed amendments. 20 years ago, that CRC, and I think many folks think, including me, I mean, that CRC did a great job. They bundled 36 proposals into 9 amendments. That's gotten very little reporting. And I even read an op-ed by a member of that CRC 20 years ago who was critical of the process. And I thought, okay, at some point he'll mention that they did the same thing. He never did. So again, I think the voters are smart. They'll read through these proposals. They'll vote them up or down. I just hope that if they don't like how something was combined, that's fine. If they think a concept doesn't belong in the Constitution, that's fine. I just hope people just don't vote no because they've heard that the process was somehow inappropriate.
I want to go to another amendment that's also a bundled package, Amendment 6.
Sure.
This one includes Marcy's Law. This was a big one for you.
And very near and dear to my heart.
the other one was raising the retirement age of judges from 70 to 75. I can sort of understand the comparison, but you explain to us why you think these two should be put together.
Sure. So Marcy's Law obviously impacts how the administration of justice and victims' participation in the justice system, and that we need to ensure that they have access and, where appropriate, an opportunity to be heard and always an opportunity to be informed of their case. The idea is, again, to try and promote some ballot brevity. How can we combine like concepts? All of these proposals in Amendment 6 had to do with the judiciary. The judges are in charge of enforcing the requisites of Marcy's Law, making sure that these victims have access, that their family members have access. So that's why to us at the time it made sense to combine it with the retirement ages of judges and then also the judge's role in evaluating evidence. Basically, there's been a lot of talk, and primarily in legal communities, about state agencies and state bureaucracies. Should those bureaucracies, when they make decisions that impact the people of Florida, should they be entitled to some type of deference in their interpretation of the law, or should a judge be able to come in afterward and fairly say, okay, we think the agency got it wrong here, without having to defer to the agency unless their decision was clearly erroneous? And that's why it made sense, we believe, to combine it with these other two provisions that dealt with the judiciary.
So let's talk about – I want to dig into Marcy's Law a little bit again.
Sure.
As you said, very close to you, very dear to your heart. But you know there's opposition to this. A lot of money has come in support of this, but there's been opposition, and I want to get your take on this. One was Broward Public Defender Howard Finkelstein, and he said that this recast criminal courts – as being something other than about determining guilt or innocence. He said this, quote, "The purpose of criminal justice is to determine the guilt or the innocence of the accused and the appropriate sentence. It's not a balancing of rights between victim and defendant." Also, another person we spoke to was Deputy Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Florida, Melba Pearson, on this program a couple of weeks ago. She's also against it, but here's what she had to say.
The Florida Constitution, as it stands right now, has a very robust victims' rights section. Victims have the right to be heard. They have the right to be present in all stages of the proceedings, whether it be the filing of charges, arraignment, trial, every aspect of trial, as well as sentencing. They have the right to be informed on what is happening with the case. So this constitutional amendment does not change anything from that perspective. But what it does do, it does give corporations the same footing as human victims. So in other words, you can now have corporations coming into criminal proceedings with high-priced lawyers trying to dictate how the criminal justice process should go.
There are two points here I want to ask you, Tim Serio.
Sure.
The one that both Finkelstein and Pearson are saying is, we already have enough on the books in Florida law. This isn't necessary. What's your take on that?
Absolutely not correct. And to call the process that we have now robust is just that's just factually inaccurate. I mean, the whole point, when we went around the state of Florida, we heard from victim after victim, victims' families, that they are not getting the opportunity to be heard. They are not getting notice of these hearings. I will say this, Ms. Pearson is correct in the sense that many things that Marcy's Law is placing into the Constitution of our state are in statute, and they are consistently not enforced. That is why we have 10 state attorneys, one of whom, Catherine Fernandez Rundle, is the state attorney where Ms. Pearson was an assistant state attorney. That's why they have endorsed Marcy's Law, because the system – I'm not blaming the judges or the prosecutors or the defense attorneys, but the system is failing because of – I mean, it is just an overwhelmed system right now. And there's got to be something when you put these rights in the Constitution – that along with an ability for the victims to enforce those rights, which Marcy's Law does, it allows a victim or their families to go to the court to say, I'm not getting the notice I'm supposed to have. That's a game changer. That is not what's happening now.
And what about the second point that Ms. Pearson brings up, that now this can help protect corporations?
That is another criticism, and let me, if I could speak to that specifically, Lewis, and then make a more general comment. That is a criticism we've heard, and it's from opponents of Marcy's Law in general. It's very difficult. It's a very popular measure, and to say that it's going to protect corporate defendants, I will say this: a mom and pop operation it can be a corporate defendant, whether it's a limited liability company. My in-laws owned an independent pharmacy in Sarasota. They were robbed at least a dozen times in 20 years. And if Marcy's Law did not allow victim – the law recognizes that a person can be a company. If it didn't allow these entities that are incorporated to be treated as victims, they would have no ability to participate or to be informed. And look, I'm sorry. If there is a if there's a Home Depot and that's robbed at gunpoint and some of the workers there are injured, to say, well, you're a big company, you have less rights. I mean, the company ought to be able to have notice when they've had workers harmed or they've been hurt. But really, this is geared toward the mom and pop operations, like my in-laws who suffered and experienced these things.
Before we finish up here, I wanted to ask
Sure.
you, the Florida Supreme Court obviously is still looking at, because there were challenges to some of these bundles, some of these amendments,
Right.
actually.
Right, right.
I mean, if they decide to take that off, first of all, how does that impact early voting?
Well, it will be very difficult. I mean, my prediction is that the Supreme Court will uphold what is still on the ballot, that these will move forward. But it would absolutely throw a monkey wrench into things. I mean, they just if a proposal is removed, then the votes for it or against it will be nullified. It won't matter. But I do think that what's on the ballot is going to remain on the ballot. And again, if I could though, Lewis, keep in mind too, when you're talking about victims' rights, I do want to say this. For many, it's a zero-sum game, and I'm not criticizing. I have many friends on the defense side who are criminal defense lawyers, but some dear friends, and I've done some criminal defense work. And there's a school of thought of every opportunity for a victim to speak is not good for their client. Okay, it's not good for them. So if you are either you're a criminal defense lawyer or you're a zealous advocate for the accused, I'm not saying that's wrong, But many are just opposed to any input from victims. And I'm just saying, as a policy, I hope the people of Florida think that a more balanced approach is appropriate, and that victim input at particular stages under the governance and oversight of a judge is the right thing to do.
So let me finish with this. The Tampa Bay Times editorial department recently came out and said voters should only vote yes on Amendment 4 and no on everything else. Now, that's their take on it. But and I know that you just talked about you're fighting for Marcy's Law. But, you know, how do you feel about, you know, right now, really, the conversation on all of these different, ballot amendments that people are going to have to pick from?
I think there's been a lot of time, a lot of work put into this, into these proposals by many folks on the CRC, but we knew what we were getting into. And I trust the people of Florida to do the right thing. And if we've got to do a better job of getting out there in the little time we have left to explain about the bundling, to explain, you know, the particular provisions, I'm happy to do that. I know I've got some other CRC, some of my other CRC fellow members are happy to do that too. That's on us, and the people of Florida at the end of the day will have the final say.
And again, Amendment 4, is because I just mentioned that's the one that they were going with, is that's the one, of course, reinstituting voting rights for former felons.
Right.
Tim Serio, member of the Constitutional Revision Commission. Again, this is a group that meets every 20 years to review Florida's Constitution. They propose new amendments. There are 12 that are on the ballot for this November. He joined us again from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Tim, it's always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis. Really appreciate it.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear a conversation with actress Alyssa Milano, who's fighting alongside the students in Parkland who want stricter gun laws. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, a number of the nation's highest profile activists have joined in on the gun control lobbying led by students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Actress Alyssa Milano, an outspoken voice in the Me Too movement and an advocate for gun control legislation, was in South Florida this week. She was at the Actions for Change Festival this past Sunday and will be speaking tonight at a fundraiser for Ban Assault Weapons Now. It's a nonprofit looking to get an assault weapons ban in the 2020 November ballot. WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman spoke with Milano on Friday. As a leader within the Me Too movement, Milano was an invited guest to the Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Stephanie Ford hearings on Thursday. The conversation began with her interest in the movement started by MSD students.
Ever since we watched as a nation children being shot and killed by an automatic weapon, I've just been enraged. And this goes to Sandy Hook. I was at a breaking point after Parkland, and really just taken by how incredibly inspiring the youth leaders were during that time when it seemed like the adults were nowhere to be found.
And you're here in South Florida to speak at a couple of fundraisers organized by some of those students and their parents. Can you tell us about the message that you plan to convey at those events?
For the Bon events, we are, you know, there's a coalition of people that want to ban assault weapons now. And it is an incredibly important issue, and I think between the Pulse survivors and the Parkland survivors, Florida is really the perfect place to do this. So we are holding our first fundraising event on Monday, October 1st, with donors and families and survivors of the Parkland and Pulse mass shootings.
I understand that's an effort to get a constitutional amendment on the 2020 ballot to ban assault weapons in Florida. Do you expect Floridians to come out and support that?
I do. You know, I think that Floridians are ready for this. I think that they've seen how these weapons affect and impact their community in a negative way and are realizing that they have the power to change that. So we need to collect signatures. We need to raise money. It's going to cost $5 million. So I think it's an important thing, and I'm just super honored that they asked me to be a part of it.
So you're also here for an event called Actions for Change Food and Music Festival. It's a benefit for two foundations that center around art and artists. Change the Ref was started by Manuel Oliver. He's a muralist whose son Joaquin was killed in the shooting. And Shine MSD was started by student musicians who wrote the song Shine. How have arts been useful for you in terms of activism or healing in your life?
Well, I think art has an incredibly powerful effect and opportunity when we are able to use art as a bridge to our divisions and where nothing else seems to bring us together because we are so calcified and fossilized in our political ideologies. Art can do that. Art can be an incredible conversation instigator. And, you know, we should always look to our artists for inspiration and light, but also the legacy that they will leave behind as far as a timestamp of where we are right now in history and how we'll be able to look back at this time through art 30 years from now and really get a snapshot of where we are, where we were, and hopefully where we've progressed from.
I wonder what you see that art looking like right now in this moment, whether it's to do with gun control activism or the Me Too movement, which you've been a prominent voice in. Have you made or seen any art recently that you said, yeah, that really captures right now?
I think Manny Oliver's sculpture of the child hiding under the desk during a mass shooting is probably the most powerful piece that I've seen dealing with gun violence, because there's nothing graphic about it, but it still really is an example of what fear looks like.
Do you see any parallels between the Me Too movement and this push for greater gun control, banning assault weapons?
I mean, I think that we are supporting victims of everything a lot more now, and really understanding that we have to come together and use our voices to protect change, because often, you know, our politicians don't have our best interests motivating them in policy.
Do you think the two movements can work together to make progress in both areas at the same time?
I think we're working to try to make progress in every issue, social issue that we're facing today under this administration. I think that, you know, whether it be civil rights or immigration rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, you know, part of, I've been an activist since I was 15 years old, and part of that, a very big part of that has always been about progressing forward. And now it just feels like a very big part of it is stopping from things from being rolled back. So it's a little heartbreaking.
So along those lines, and just shifting gears briefly, you were present at the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. There was a lot written in the national media leading up to the hearings about how they were going to be a test of the Me Too movement, of whether anything has changed because of that, whether it would be easier for sexual assault survivors to speak out, or whether they would be more likely to be believed. I wonder if you see it that way, as a test of Me Too.
I don't think it's a test of Me Too, but I do think it's a testament to every woman's worst fear realized. I mean, I think that we have seen our worst fear in coming forward and, you know, talking about our experiences and what that looks like, you know, on a level of fear, potentially not being believed, having public scrutiny. Everything that Dr. Ford has gone through is our worst fear as survivors. As far as Me Too, I don't think Me Too can really be tested, because I think within the tests is conversation. And these are conversations that need to be had. And often these are hard conversations, and often they're emotional conversations. but we have to talk about it to be able to set boundaries, to be able to hold people accountable, to really show, shine a light on what we have had to deal with for generations upon generations. You know, boundaries are a big part of this, and I don't think that we've really established those ever before. So all of this conversation is about setting boundaries.
Where do you think that conversation is headed now in light of the hearings?
I think that we now need to, you know, more than even before, as women, we need to stand up and we need to drive each other to the elections, and we need to elect politicians that have women's rights at the forefront of their policy agendas.
And again, that was WLRN reporter Jessica Bateman speaking with celebrity activist Alyssa Milano. You can find more details on our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Broward County's senior population is expected to boom in the next decade, but is the county ready? More on that on coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Florida has long been a destination for senior citizens around the country, but Broward County is on the verge of what experts call a silver tsunami. A new report from the United Way of Broward and the Community Foundation of Broward and the Jewish Foundation of Broward County shows that tens of thousands of residents in Broward will age into and pass the retirement age in the next decade. The issues of lack of affordable housing for senior citizens, as well as public transit options, are expected to be exacerbated by this growing senior population. Well, we talked with WLRN reporter Katie Switalski via Skype recently. She interviewed the authors of the report and a number of seniors throughout Broward County.
So right now, Lewis, Broward County has the fastest growing population in the whole state of Florida of people 85 and older. And what that really looks like is by 2030, that population is expected to go from close to 48,000 people right now to more than 63,000 people that age.
All right. So do we know why Broward County in particular is seeing so many retirees? Why is that such a popular place?
A little bit yes, a little bit no. So it starts with the stigma that Florida is this stereotypical, idyllic place to retire with the palm trees and the sunshine. But a lot of the people I talked to came here for jobs when there was a big boom about 20 years ago and have stayed. Even on another note, Broward has over 80,000 veterans. So I think all of these factors really roll in and combine to have a larger retiree senior population here.
All right, let's talk about some of the primary issues that are facing Broward's senior population. And we'll start with affordable housing. You talk about seniors, some of them living off Social Security and retirement savings. I mean, what kind of options are there?
There's a few options. You can apply to be on Broward County's wait list for affordable housing. But it's common if you make too much Social Security that you won't qualify. And this is a wait list that you can apply to. And if you qualify, you'll be notified if lower cost apartment units do free up that you can potentially move into.
And are these permanent or temporary housing situations?
So it is a permanent option. There's not enough affordable housing units right now, but it looks like apartment complexes that are built specifically for the purpose of being lower cost.
You talked with the Broward County Commissioner about the issues surrounding seniors in condominiums. Let's take a listen.
They have Social Security. They have, you know, their Medicare, which doesn't cover all of their drug costs and things like that. Then their apartments, their condos are deteriorating, and they get an assessment. Well, they can't afford a $50,000 assessment. They can't afford to pay it.
What exactly is a condo assessment, and how is it putting a greater financial burden on seniors?
So this is not just unique to Broward. Condo assessments are really common across South Florida, especially in Palm Beach and Miami-Dade counties as well. But basically what it is, you know, every so often, every few years, condo buildings need repairs. So typically a condo association or a board will come to the residents, make an assessment of the building of their unit, and charge them for the cost of repairs over several years. And those costs get factored into your monthly payments to live there. But sometimes it is a daunting amount of money that gets tacked on to someone's rent each month. And that really does increase people's cost of living.
From the people you spoke to, the seniors that you spoke with, did you get a sense how much they needed to budget for their savings or Social Security to go just towards housing?
Oh, yes. So for this piece, I took a few weeks and interviewed about 10 different seniors and retirees. Some were working, some were not. They're all older than 65. And nearly every single one of them is spending at least half of the monthly income that they have, like Social Security and any pension payments, just on rent and cost of living. So that's huge. I mean, it's at least 50% of what is available to them every month.
And we talk about these folks who, you know, again, half of what they have is going just to housing. But do we know the financial demographics for seniors in Broward? I mean, do we know how many seniors are living below the poverty line, or, you know, how many are middle income or even high income residents?
So we do know, I mean, Broward County's senior poverty line is much higher than the national average. 12.9% of seniors in Broward County, which is, I mean, it's almost basically 13%, are living below that poverty line. And so to compare, the national average for that is only 9%. And it's interesting because Broward County homelessness organizations are seeing more homeless seniors than they were a few years ago.
Did you get a sense of how many, of them are actually still, they have to work, they can't retire?
Yes. And so at least half the people I talked to were still working, whether in a small capacity, like volunteering and getting stipends for travel, or, you know, in minimum wage jobs. And a lot of them, it's really interesting. The ones that did retire that I spoke with couldn't retire until later. So you think of 65 as this bar to retire. And really, the people I was speaking with retired at 74, 75, 76 years old.
And you say some of them are getting part-time jobs. What kind of jobs are they getting?
So the seniors I spoke with work for the SOFIA, which is the South Florida Institute on Aging. It's located in Fort Lauderdale, and it's volunteer-based, volunteer programs. But the institute does give seniors $2.50 an hour to visit other seniors and help them out, or even visit local schools.
I'm talking with WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Switalski, and we're looking at the issues facing the county's aging population, including housing affordability. We're going to talk about transportation, emotional support, and a lot more. She's joining us right now via Skype. So, Katie, for many seniors, the issues of transit are essential for getting help to homes when they need it most. And you talk with senior Jan Jones, who does work with a lot of the elderly in Broward. Let's listen.
You can always get help if you need it in your household. I have a man that house is absolutely filthy and he can't get any help. It's so run down and so dirty, and I've tried everywhere to get help for him. If something happens to my daughter, I'd be concerned if I could have help in my house.
So tell us more about Jan's story and how she gets around Broward County.
So Jan is a delight. I mean, she's almost 84 years old. Her birthday is in November, and she lives in Oakland Park. She lives with her daughter, and she still drives to get around, visit the other elderly people that she, you know, meets with each week. And she's one of the people that is really happy that she can still drive. She was hoping that, you know, at her age, she would be able to still drive. But I don't think to the extent that she has to drive. And so she gets really frustrated with traffic, and there's not, you know, the roads are a little crazy for anybody, but especially as we get older. So transportation is the main issue at the top of her mind. And it's interesting because she says she knows there's help available, but she doesn't always know where to go to find those resources. And I think that fits so many seniors in Broward County.
Public transit is such a challenge for communities all over South Florida. But how is Broward County, you know, talking about and thinking about public transit options for this particular part of the population, for seniors?
So there is a plan for seniors included in this transportation surtax that's going to be on the November ballot. And the plan includes the county purchasing and operating more TOPS buses. And those are small shuttles that pick up seniors who request them to transport them to and from doctor's offices for medical appointments. And right now, it's not an efficient system. The county will admit that many seniors have frustrations with TOPS buses taking too long or not picking them up. And so part of what this transportation surtax will do, it's a penny tax that if it passes in November, sales tax would go up by 1%. But that part of that would go towards, you know, buying more of these shuttles and operating them for seniors.
And what's been the public response to that sales tax increase?
That's been pretty mixed from what I've seen, a little half and half. People are obviously frustrated with transportation. They're obviously really frustrated with traffic options right now. But there is a degree of, hey, you know, this tax being 30 years long is a long period of time. Is it worth it for me to pay? Will anything actually get done?
So we're going to have a documentary on our show that looks at the political activism of seniors in Broward County. Do you get a sense that affordable housing and transportation are the key issues from a voting standpoint for seniors that you spoke with in Broward?
Absolutely. These people have spent their entire lives working. And at ages 70, 75, and 80, they're still struggling to make ends meet every day with basic food items, medication, housing, transportation. And that seems to be a huge motivating factor into their frustration. And they want to see more efficiency in the way that senior services are provided, whether that's at the county level, whether that's, you know, at their city level.
Katie, what else did you find in that report that jumped out at you?
The fact that over 6,500 seniors in Broward right now are on waiting lists for elder services. And this is all before this silver tsunami gets here, right? So I think the takeaway, that the main point of this report was, hey, we need to change some of the ways that seniors in Broward can, you know, have access to services before so many more people here age into this bracket that need the services. If it's already a crowded playing field, there's only going to be more that comes in the next 5 to 10 years, especially.
And again, that was WLRN reporter Katie Switalski. And you can hear her full story and read the report about the silver tsunami in Broward County by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, seniors tend to vote in higher numbers than other groups, but not all seniors are the same. We're going to meet a group of folks from Broward's Winmore community. They're part of a new documentary. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, as of the 2018 midterms, they are coming very quickly. There's a segment of the population in South Florida that will have a definitively large impact on those elections, our senior population. Senior citizens traditionally have the highest voter turnout of any demographic. 70% of registered seniors came out, for the 2016 election. If there's one community in South Florida that's indicative of that power, it would be the Winmore Retirement Community in Broward County. Winmore has become a traditional stop on the tour for both statewide and national political campaigns. The retirement community is the focus of a new documentary entitled A Greater Society. This is from the beginning of the film.
When we had the presidential election, I mean, everybody and their uncle was here. Everybody came to Broward County.
Vice President Joe Biden.
And if they come to Broward County, they want to come to Winmore.
Broward County is ground zero. And you are the difference makers that make it ground zero.
When you're running for office, Winmore is a must-stop. When they turn out in the numbers that they historically have, they make a huge difference in the outcome of elections.
They really count on us to get the votes out and sway the election.
Each of us have a responsibility to make sure everyone that we know gets out and votes.
350 people in one room, all of whom are going to vote, all of whom understand that it's their civic duty and their responsibility and that their activism makes a difference.
Well, joining us in studio now to talk about the film is one of Winmore's residents and a featured character, Minerva Nazario. Minerva, such a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us by Skype are the directors, Stacy Goldate and Craig Colton. Again, Stacy, Craig, it's such a pleasure. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Minerva, let me start with you. How would you describe the political engagement in the Winmore retirement community? How involved is everybody when it comes to elections?
Very involved.
I mean, what's it like? How, you know, what kind of things are you doing?
Myself?
Yeah.
I try to concentrate in the Hispanic people that live in the community. Mine is more of a word of mouth. Personally to each Hispanic that I meet in Winmore. my first question to them is, have you registered? Are you going out to vote? So it's a one-to-one. Plus, we have a club of Latino women in Whitmore, and we encourage them to register. We encourage them to vote, not only them, but also to tell their family to go register and vote.
What do you do when you run into somebody who says, no, I haven't registered?
Well, some of the people, especially with the Hispanic, they might say, well, I'm not a U.S. citizen yet. But then I ask them, but do you have any other members in your family?
Yeah.
So could you please tell them how important it is for you to vote?
Why do you think, by the way, usually you see it in elections, that, you know, your demographic of the population has a higher voter turnout? Why is that?
Well, you have to realize one thing, that the people we elect are going to make decisions that is going to affect our Social Security, is going to affect our Medicare, is going to affect our health program, and many other things. So we have to go out to vote.
Stacey and Craig, how unique of a retiree community is Whitmore in that sense? Or could it be indicative of other retirement communities across the state of Florida or even the country?
Well, I think it's in the sense that people who are older, as you said, are more likely to vote. There's going to be that kind of a response. Whitmore is, our understanding is that Whitmore is particularly known to have a large turnout, and it's more predominantly democratically leaning. So it's especially an important stop there.
And why is that? Why is that particular community lean more Democrat when you tend to see other retirement communities, especially in Florida, tend to lean a little more right?
Well, I think it's because a lot of the people who retired to Whitmore were from the Northeast. So in the 70s, you had a lot of, and advertising was geared towards people in New York and Philadelphia who were tired of the cold. So they were the snowbirds who eventually became residents, and many of them were Democrats.
And you have an interesting connection to this community, Stacey.
I do. My grandmother and my great aunt were two of the original residents of Whitmore.
And at what point did you decide, well, okay, this is a community, you've got to tell their story?
Well, Craig and I were driving to work one day, and we heard a story on NPR, our Los Angeles affiliate, and Greg Allen said that Vice President Joe Biden was making a campaign stop in 2012 to campaign for President Obama, and that blew our minds. We were not expecting that.
Craig, when you go in to want a film, you know, you've got to get personal with people. And, you know, and not everybody's used to having the camera in their face. I mean, what is that process of talking with these folks and convincing them that you believe their story is one worth telling, and this is how you're going to do it? You're going to follow them around for a while.
Yeah, well, the thing about Whitmore is that it's a gated private community, so you just can't walk in there and start filming. So we actually had to go before a committee of residents, a room of about 100 people, and explain to them what the documentary was going to be about, the process of shooting, how long it was going to take, because they were concerned about the image and how they were going to be portrayed. But once we got their blessing, then everyone was coming to us and saying, oh, you have to talk to this person. You got to talk to Ronnie. She's the president of the Democratic Club. You have to talk to Jack, president of the Conservative Club. You got to meet Minerva. So that was exciting, just to meet people and actually embed ourselves. We embedded ourselves in the community for about 4 months. For about the first couple of weeks, they were a little, not nervous, but aware of our cameras. They'd make fun of us and say, oh, there's those people with the cameras again. But after about 2 weeks, they completely ignored us. So being able to be a fly on the wall and pick up the actions and the everyday workings of this community was really exciting for us.
I'm talking with director Stacey Goldate and Craig Colton. They are behind the new documentary film entitled A Greater Society. It follows the Winmore retirement community in Broward County during the 2014 midterm elections and the role they played in getting seniors out to vote. We're also talking with Minerva Nazadio. She's a Winmore resident and one of the folks featured in the film. Minerva, what was it like when they said, yeah, we want to come in, we want to film, follow you around, put cameras on you all the time? Yeah, I mean, what's that like?
At the beginning, I did not feel comfortable because I didn't know Stacy, I didn't know Craig. But, you know, as time went by, I can see what they were trying to do. So I went alone.
And, they, like Craig said, after a while, you just forgot they were there? You got used to it?
Well, you never really get used to it, you know, but you said, OK, I am willing to try. So that's exactly what we did. And some of the members in our club.
You know, he was talking about and something fascinating about this. The film is it points out that you have a large group of seniors in the community and they're known as Roosevelt Democrats. What does that mean?
It means that they've been Democrats for a long, long time.
Have you been a Democrat most of your life? Or,
you know, it's, I am.
I should ask you, are you a Democrat or Republican? Or if you don't want to answer, that's okay too.
I am originally from Puerto Rico. And my family moved to Philadelphia. And then as a young woman, I went to work in an anti-poverty program in the Virgin Islands. And the reason why I mention Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands is because the citizens of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, even though we are U.S. citizens, we cannot vote in the elections here in the United States, especially, you know, for the president and things like that.
Right, when you're in Puerto Rico.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Well, so 2008 was the first time that I was going to vote for a president, for a senator, and everything like that. And since then, even in the Virgin Islands, I was involved in the local elections.
Yeah.
And when I moved to the United States, I said, of course, I was so glad that I was able to exercise that, you know, to be able to vote for the president of the United States.
That's an interesting point that you bring up about folks who, when you live in a territory, you can't vote when you're in the territory. Craig, real quickly, I asked about Roosevelt Democrats. Again, you touch on that in throughout the film, but how would you describe it?
Well, a Roosevelt Democrat is someone that was born turn of the century or a little after and actually went through the Depression. They saw the creation of the New Deal laws that President Roosevelt put together, and along with that, Social Security, et cetera. And it's basically a dying generation. There's very few people alive today that actually remember the Depression. So that whole demographic of Roosevelt Democrats is vanishing. And actually, two of the our main characters in the film were original Roosevelt Democrats, Stacy's grandmother and great aunt. So they are very liberal. They support programs. They feel the government should put in its fair share to support these programs, and unfortunately, because they are vanishing, there's that support system seems to be diminishing, and it's important for older people or our kids, our grandchildren, to remember what their great grandparents did for them.
Yeah. Real quickly, Stacey, in 30 seconds, if you could, let me know about you, because this is the 2014 midterm that you followed them, but you're still in touch with folks. I mean, how still involved? Are they still as you know, passionate about elections as we're coming up on one?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. And I think all their grandparents are, too. I mean, I think a lot of people are going to vote in November, and I hope so.
And Stacey, where could people see this film?
Sure. Well, actually, we are having our Miami premiere on Wednesday, October 17th at Filmgate Miami. So people can learn more about that through Filmgate Miami or on our website, agreatersociety.com. And if they're not able to make it, the film is available on Vimeo On Demand. So all that's on our website, agreatersociety.com.
And that film, again, director Stacey Goldate and Craig Colton. We also heard from Minerva Nazadio, Winmore resident, also one of the folks featured in the film. I really appreciate all your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
Thank you so much.
That's the program for today. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.